This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, professor of television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey, in for Terry Gross. We're going to remember the influential and larger-than-life fashion editor Andre Leon Talley. He died Tuesday at the age of 73. An enthusiastic champion of fashion, he was the first black man to hold the position of creative director at Vogue magazine. He worked there for much of his career, first as fashion news director and later as editor-at-large. At 6 feet 6 inches tall, often wearing capes and caftans created for him by some of the world's top designers, he was an unmistakable sight. Talley grew up in Durham, North Carolina, in the Jim Crow era. His grandmother, who raised him, was a maid who worked for Duke University. The fashions he was exposed to came largely from what people wore to church on Sundays, until, at age 9, he discovered Vogue magazine. After getting a scholarship to Brown University and a master's degree in French literature, he moved to New York, worked at Andy Warhol's magazine Interview, and was mentored by former Vogue editor Diana Vreeland. Terry Gross spoke to Andre Leon Talley in 2018 when he was the subject of the documentary The Gospel According to Andre Leon Talley.
Andre Leon Talley, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with, how were you introduced to the world of fashion?
Well, from an early age, I discovered fashion through the pages of Vogue. I went to the public library in Durham, North Carolina, and I was about 10 years old, or maybe 9, and I discovered this magazine called Vogue. And in those days, it came out on the 1st and the 15th of every month, and the editor was Diana Vreeland. And this was my escape world. When I was a young boy, I grew up in my grandmother's home in Durham, North Carolina, a modest home. She was a maid at Duke University. And it was just my grandmother and myself. She was an extraordinary woman. She was a frugal woman. And she watched her budget. She had a bank account. And we had a wonderful life because I never knew anything but love, unconditional love.
So you're a 9-year-old boy, and you're totally fascinated by these fashions that adult women are wearing. So what captivated you as a 9-year-old boy about the world of Vogue?
The world of Vogue meant more to me than what the women were wearing as models. The issues of Vogue captivated me not only for the images of the fashion spreads, but it was the magazine itself that turned me onto a world that I did not know or had not been exposed to. It was the world of literature, what was happening in the world of art, what was happening in the world of entertainment. It was my a gateway to the world outside of Durham, North Carolina. It wasn't just the fashions. Of course, I love the fashions. I love the beautiful images, and I related so much to the images and then the written words, the captions, the articles. So I was living through Vogue as an escape hatch, but reading every single page, loving every single detail. I mean, they had a men's column called Men in Vogue, and that was very fascinating to me. And it was a world that I internalized and I kept to myself as a young man because no one was interested in Vogue or fashion other than I. And I was ripping pages out of Vogue, putting the pictures up on my wall in my room with thumbtacks. And I just had a room wallpapered from head to ceiling, floor to ceiling, with images from Vogue.
So just to set the scene, while you're entering the world of Vogue and very much wanting to live in that world of fashion and literature and music and art. Yeah. So describe the actual house you were living in.
My grandmother's house was very modest. It was a house of 4 rooms, a kitchen, living room, 2 bedrooms, and 1 bath. And we did not have central heating. I remember we had coal heating when I was very young, and then we converted to gas heating. We had a gas stove in the front bedroom where I slept, and then we had a gas stove in the kitchen, which heated up my grandma's bedroom. But this house was a house of immaculate cleanliness. My grandmother was a great, great housekeeper. She gave me the chores of scrubbing the front porch, scrubbing the floors. I had to scrub the floors once a week. I also learned to polish the woodwork in the living room with Johnson's paste wax, CRA paste wax. That was hard so I get the floor to shine. And I did this as a young man. And all the time, my grandmother was going to work to be a maid. She'd come home at 3 o'clock every afternoon, make supper. We'd sit down and look at the one little TV we had. My father had bought the TV for me from Washington, D.C. We had a black and white television. And I remember in the house, the stove was a very great memory for me in the kitchen because of the smells from the kitchen were wonderful. I remember my grandmother making wonderful lemon pound cakes and the smell of vanilla extract, McCormick's vanilla extract.
Oh, yes.
The color of the vanilla extract mm-hmm. and the smell was mm-hmm. amazing. Still lingers in my memory.
So were you bullied when you were in high school?
Of course I was bullied. I was bullied and beaten up and everything.
What was your defense?
I would get on the school bus, and I would say something, and they would just pounce on me. Because also, I had beautiful clothes. I didn't have a lot of clothes, but my grandmother and my father would put me in the best clothes they could afford. And I had beautiful sweaters and trousers and beautiful penny loafers and quality shoes. And I didn't show off. I wasn't a show off. I wasn't showing off. But I would just get on the school bus, and I was tall and skinny, and they just would beat me up.
So was there a way you could defend yourself?
I only defended myself through silence and not being a disruptor. I didn't fight back. I didn't know how to fight back. And I didn't know how to articulate this to my grandmother or anyone.
So I want to kind of collapse a period of your life here. So you
collapse it, Dolly. Yeah, collapse.
So after you graduate high school, you go to college. Then you move to Rhode Island to go to Brown University for your master's.
Yes.
Your undergraduate
yes.
and master's degree both
I got
in
my
French
undergraduate
literature.
Degree in French literature. And mm-hmm. I tell you, when I went to Brown and won that scholarship, the world opened. When I got on the train, I went to Brown on a train from Durham. My uncle went with me. He rode with me to Philadelphia. I had all these boxes on the train. It was the first time ever being away from home. So I went to Brown alone. I went to the campus alone. I navigated my way alone. And I got to Brown and the world opened up. The world of exposure, the world of literature, I discovered even more. The great, great poets, Baudelaire, Rimbaud. I discovered the beautiful paintings of Eugène Delacroix. I discovered Manet. I discovered the great worlds of art, things, music. Music had not been, classical music had not been a part of my upbringing. Gospel music and church music. And in the world of Brown, I discovered beautiful classical music, piano music, Chopin, Clara Schumann. Things like this were really new to me, and I was so curious about everything, and the people were so sophisticated at Brown and at RISD, the Rhode Island School of Design. So I just had the world open up to me in just ways that had never been open to me before.
You know what? I realize you are one of the few guests I've had who talks even faster than I do.
I'm talking fast, but I'm loving it. I hope you understand it.
I absolutely understand, and I'm quite enjoying it. So you get to New York after graduating from Brown. And you'd always wanted to meet Andy Warhol and the people who he helped make famous. And you not only got to meet them, you got to work at his magazine, Interview Magazine, which I should say parenthetically just filed for bankruptcy.
And closed.
And closed, yeah.
So, it folded.
So when you were there and got to see all of the like Warhol superstars and everything, what made the biggest impression on you in terms of your own life, in terms of your own personal and professional identity? Because you were in your early 20s, I imagine, at the time. And it's a very formative period when you're still, you know, shaping who you are and figuring out who you want to be. And you're looking at all these people who kind of remade themselves, who transformed themselves into something else.
I loved it. I loved the world. Now, the people that I met through Warhol were the people that I always wanted to know. They were not bullies. They did not judge you. There was unconditional admiration, if not love. People were free. People had made their choices. People were different. You know, some people perhaps had better clothes than others. But everyone was noted for their own worth, their own gifts. And I think that's why I felt so good, because I felt at home. I felt that I was part of a special club at Andy Warhol's Interview Magazine. And they embraced me, and there was no criticism of me as it would have been at home in Durham, North Carolina. You know, I was brought up in a very strict, modest home, but my The nucleus of my family was church. So being a black man brought up in the African-American Missionary Baptist Church culture meant that I had certain rules and certain ways to deport myself through clothes and not only through my actions or attitudes about life. But when I got to meet Andy Warhol, and people were walking around in jeans and blazers and sometimes Rive Gauche and sometimes not Rive Gauche, the world came through the doors of the factory in Andy Warhol. Interview was the gateway to the world for me.
Well, another thing about the Andy Warhol crowd is that there was a lot of gender and sexual fluidity,
but it wasn't rampant and it wasn't overt. People went into the office, and there was a deportment about going into the factory. You had a certain culture of the office and the factory, which was very correct, very traditional, yet very relaxed and casual. There were all kinds of people. There were lesbians, there were gays, there were straight, there were drag queens, there were artists. But everyone was equal. So everyone mattered, and no matter who you were, it mattered. You mattered because you had individual gifts and talents, and that's what Andy admired. Now, there wasn't a lot of sexuality going on. I did not see people having sex rampantly at work or taking drugs because it wasn't that atmosphere. When I got to the factory, it was long after Andy had an assassination attempt. So the rules changed. So people were chosen for their seriousness and chosen for their possibilities to become who they wanted to be. And I was allowed to become who I wanted to be at the factory and with Andy Warhol.
Right. So eventually you get to Vogue. You were a man at Vogue. You were also an African-American man at Vogue.
Yes,
so
yes.
So I'm sure you stood out. Did you feel like you were with your people,
felt,
or did you feel like you were
bullied.
Separate?
I felt that I was on top of the world. I felt that I was with the best people. After all, Vreeland had endorsed me. I had the full endorsement. It was like if you had a political endorsement. It was the full endorsement of Vreeland and Andy Warhol, who were, for me, the king and queen of New York. The Empress of Fashion had endorsed me. I had proven to her I had assignments and challenges she gave me for certain installations in her shows. And I had proven to her my worth. I never feared anything. I never doubted myself once. I am a deeply insecure person for many reasons. I never showed my insecurity. I just rose to the occasion. I stood up straight and tall, like a tall, tall sunflower. And I just radiated the light and the beauty of my mind in relationship to the world of fashion.
So one of your contributions in terms of personal style to fashion is your capes and your caftans.
Mm-hmm.
How did you start wearing them? And I should say these are not ordinary capes. These are like amazingly designed, like sometimes out of fur.
Articulated fur and just thought out and processed with the great class, world-class designers. Well, when I went to Marrakesh and saw that the men in North Africa, in Marrakesh and Casablanca, walked around in caftan shirts and loose clip-fitting clothes all day, every day. They woke up, they put on their long-sleeved, to-the-floor ankle shirts to the floor. They had caftans, and this is the indigenous dress of the black man in Marrakesh. And this is, I decided, I want to be like that. I want to wear that instead of a suit because it's comfortable, you're ventilated, you're roomy, you're cozy, and you can just stretch. And I'm not a tall stick anymore. I'm a big, big guy of great girth. And people think I look like maybe my clothes don't look that important, but I have taken great time in fittings for my capes and caftans made by the great designers. So I will continue to wear these things to the rest of my life.
Did your weight have anything to do with wanting to wear capes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My weight issue is an ongoing thing. It's an ongoing battle. I've battled it, but I've had weight issues. And, of course, my weight issues are obviously go back to my childhood and the loss of love. And I associate food with love. My grandmother used to make me a pan of biscuits every Sunday morning just for myself. And you don't know how wonderful that smell is of those hot biscuits with butter and molasses. I have carried that throughout my life. She would make lemon pound cakes. At Christmas, we have fruit cakes, chocolate cake, coconut cake, lemon pound cake, four or five cakes, six pies sitting, waiting to be eaten on Christmas Day for the family.
But you were skinny as a young man, so something changed.
Something changed when my grandmother died. It was when my grandmother died, I started eating for love, and I just don't know how to discipline it. I'm sorry. Everyone in America is perhaps overweight, and I totally emphasize what people emphasize. I did select caftans because the caftans create a stately, tall image. You can look great in them and look slim.
So one of the things you mention in the new documentary about you is that you've never had a long-term romantic partner and that you were, you know, very preoccupied with your profession and loved your profession very much. Have you reflected a lot on why you think you never went in that direction?
Well, I was as young as first in America, was a dear friend of mine, said, I was afraid to fall in love. I was afraid of the rejection. I was afraid of emotional commitment. And I was not deliberately making the navigating through the shores and chiffon trenches of my career. It just wasn't a part of me. Because although I lived in a world of great promiscuity and libertine ways in the 70s, Studio 54, Paris, and I discovered the freedom of people embracing people for their individuality or not just their sexuality, that you could be gay, you could be quadrosexual or pansexual, as Janelle Monáe says. I just loved living the life that I lived, living through the world that I was exposed to on the front row from fashion. I was emotionally afraid of people, so I did not want to get close to people. I did not want people to touch me. I didn't like to touch people. So that is just a part of who I am, and I regret to this day. I have difficulty responding to physical emotion. And it's based on, I guess, a childhood experience. I don't know what it is. I can't relate to that. I can't think about that now. But I do regret not having that relationship. I regret not having siblings. And I think about it almost every day because as I get older, it's very, very lonely. I have lived a lonely life. I live in my own guilt, gold-plated hell. As Tennessee Williams says, I know the gold-plated hell I'm going to. I have a beautiful home. I have beautiful books, beautiful furniture, beautiful art, beautiful music. I love movies. I have beautiful clothes, but I live in a gold-plated hell. However, I am not going to say it's the worst life. It's been a wonderful life.
You know, you're talking about how you were quiet when you were growing up and alone, and you're so gregarious and so talkative and so easy to talk to, it seems like two different Andre Leontalis.
There is two different Andre Leontalis, as I said. Of course there are two different Andre Leontalis. Because I have someone to talk to who's listening to what I have to say. And I didn't have that when I was growing up. I was very much a silent person. I was afraid of people. I went through high school thinking no one liked me, and then I realized people really adored me in high school. It's just amazing how I went through high school thinking I was an outsider, and I didn't discuss that with anyone. I had no one to discuss that with at home.
Well, people were beating you up also, so you had every reason to think you were an outsider.
Yeah, I was an outsider. I was an outsider with class and style, and I knew that I had style. I knew that I had style based on something very strong. I remember when I would see Ed Sullivan and the great talents he would have, like Tina Turner, Ike Turner, James Brown. Those people impacted upon me. Ike Turner had a big belt, and I wanted a belt just like that. I remember he was on the cover of Ebony Magazine on 1971, May, and he had this big belt and a red sweater with no sleeves and plaid trousers tucked in the boots, and I wanted to look like Ike Turner. I didn't want to be like Ike Turner beating up Tina Turner, but I wanted to have that look.
I hope those looks.
I aspired to. I wanted to look like a pirate.
When your grandmother died in 1989, did she have a clue how successful you'd become?
Oh, she was very proud of me. She was very proud. She had a great clue. She knew. She spoke to Mrs. Vreeland. She knew I was on the top of the world at Vogue. She was very proud.
Did you dress her at all?
Of course I did.
What were good grandmother clothes for her?
Well, good grandmother clothes were not necessarily clothes. They were accessories. And in the summer, I would go to Garfinkel's when I was a park ranger in the government, the park ranger at the Lincoln Memorial and a park ranger at the Fort Washington. And I would go spend all my money on gloves, kids' loft, leather gloves, for my grandmother to wear to church, black leather gloves, and I'd buy her beautiful Carré handbags, K K-O-R-E-T. These are all the bags and things I discovered at Vogue. And then I would buy her sometimes shoes, but I was not big on shoes because I bought a pair of the very expensive alligator shoes once on a very high heel, a thick high heel. And I remember she did not wear them much, and she didn't want to hurt my feelings. She just didn't wear them much, and I realized that I made the bad choice because the heels were too high. But she loved all the things that I bought. I bought beautiful hats, and Karl Lagerfeld used to give me beautiful fabric from his collections at Chloe, and I would take the fabric home, and she'd have beautiful dresses made, and those dresses are still in my closet. And then finally, when I got to be big at Vogue, I would buy Chanel suits from the ready-to-wear and give them to my grandmother to wear to church. And she loved them, and she was very proud. A navy blue suit and a pink suit.
All right. It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Well, Terry, it's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Andre Leon Talley speaking with Terry Gross in 2018. The influential fashion editor died Tuesday at age 73. After a break, we remember singer Ronnie Spector, who died last week at age 78. And I'll review The Gilded Age, the new costume drama series from Julian Fellowes, the creator of Downton Abbey. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air. Last week, we lost one of the distinctive voices of early rock and roll, Ronnie Spector, the lead singer of the Ronettes. She died at the age of 78. The Ronettes were perhaps the greatest girl group of the early rock era, with hit records like Be My Baby, Baby I Love You, and Walking in the Rain. An obituary in The Guardian noted, quote, "With their towering black beehive hairdos, extravagant eye makeup, and tight sheath dresses, the Ronettes brought a whiff of sex and danger to the wholesome girl group genre of the early 60s. Unquote. Ronnie Spector was born Veronica Bennett. She and her multiracial bandmates grew up in the Washington Heights area of Manhattan. She married her record producer, Phil Spector, known for his big wall of sound, but he abused her, and they later divorced. The Ronettes broke up in 1967. Terry Gross spoke to Ronnie Spector in 1987 when she had started to record and perform again on her own. They started their conversation, though, with this 1963 classic.
Spector, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Terry.
How did you first hear this song? Did the songwriter sing it for you before you performed it the first time?
Well, the first time I heard it, you know, Phil and those were and Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry. We met in a little studio, and they started writing around me. And I guess I was 16 years old and very shy, and I liked Phil at the time, and he liked me. I think they wrote it all around that. You know, our little love affair at the beginning. I think it was all a part of that, the lyrics and stuff.
Do you remember the recording session?
Like it was yesterday.
What was it like?
It was incredible because there I was in California recording, and I'd never left New York. I'd never been out of New York in my whole life. And there I am on a plane going to California by myself without the other two Ronettes, just to do the lead part. And I remember being in the ladies' room at the New York airport, just singing in the bathroom, "Be My," because I don't read music or anything, and I don't play any instruments. So it was like you had to just learn it over and over. And then Phil asked me to come to California and do it at Gold Star Studios. And that's where we recorded it. Just a record that I remember that day being in the studio. I remember what color dress I was wearing. I remember everything.
Now, as we'll hear, one of the things you do on this record is your famous, I can't even imitate this,
but
Yeah, your famous what-uh-oh.
Yes.
Which you do a lot in Be My Baby and in a lot of your early records. Mm-hmm. How did you come up with that? Was that something you just started singing?
No, it was like Frankie Lyman used to sing, "Why do birds sing so gay? And love is away with break of day. Why do they fall in love?" And so I sort of got it from him, and it was like my own little ho-ho's came out. You know, I think it was like I was 3 years old. I was singing this song. What was it called? I can't even remember. But it was like one of those yodeling songs for my family. And I think it's just something that I started and it stuck. The ho 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 ho. As a matter of fact, when I did the Eddie Money song, "Take Me Home Tonight," I did the ho-ohs without any music or anything. And then they added that to the track.
Can we talk about some of those old memories about how you started to sing? You formed the Ronettes with two of your cousins when you were all teenagers.
No, a sister and a cousin.
A sister and a cousin. Okay. Now, how did you learn to sing harmonies?
Actually, it was like a bunch of cousins. I had so many first cousins. And I remember being on the rooftop, you know, rehearsing and trying to get our routines together and stuff for the Brooklyn Fox. We had a sort of strict upbringing. So we couldn't go out, and we could look out in the street and watch other girls walk and everything, but we couldn't go out because our grandmother was very strict. So we stayed in the house, and that's how we all just started singing, because out of boredom and out of all the people in our neighborhood were, like, becoming stars, like Frankie Lyman and stuff. And when I met him, I was in love with him. I didn't even know him, and I was in love with him. I was in love with his voice.
What kind of neighborhood was it that you grew up in?
I grew up in Spanish Harlem, which was terrific because it was like every race, every color, every language. It was wonderful. My father's Irish, and my mother is black and Indian. And every time somebody says black and Indian, they say, "Oh, come on, they don't have Indian." My mother is really half Indian, and she has a high cheekbones. And so I do look like all of those races.
You broke into the music business by being a dancer at the Peppermint Lounge, being a dancer on the Murray the K Show,
right,
singing backup vocals. Did you do things in those early days to help get yourself noticed? Did you either, like, dress in such a way as to call attention to yourself? Okay, what'd you do?
First of all, you have to have a gimmick in this business, we figured. And so we wore our hair extra high, you know, the beehives in the 60s, and we wore eyeliner, and we wore slits up the side of our dresses because we sang and danced. So we really looked different. And what was the question? I forget. I get so excited.
Oh, about things you did to call attention to yourself when you were trying to break in.
See, when we first, we decided to dress up, and we had a lot of aunts. My mother has, like, six sisters, and so that's seven of them dressing us, and they told us to put a cigarette in our mouth. And we stood outside the Peppermint Lounge, dressed just alike. And I was so glad because at 14 I was smoking. They just didn't know it. And it was great because we stood online, and we had to look older, so we had to exaggerate everything because all of us were underage. So it was very hard, but we had our gimmick. And it was amazing because before we even had Be My Baby as a hit record, being at the Brooklyn Fox's Murray the K's Dancing Girls, we would come out for lunch and it was actual girls dressed like us and our hairstyles. It was knocking me out. I couldn't believe it.
You had some of the highest hair in the whole music business.
Well, that's what I said. You had to have a little attention. And we certainly brought attention with those high hairdos. I mean, we must have worn our hair at least 10 inches high.
Now, you know, it always made me think that you were really tough, really streetwise.
No.
Were you? No?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, when we heard about people being junkies or dope addicts, I would ask my mother, let me see one, because I wasn't a tough streetwise kid at all. But we just did all the dances. You know, and by living in Spanish Harlem, you learned all the dances anyway. I mean, you could just look out the window and people were on the corner singing and stuff. And it was just how and I loved it. From the time I was 3 years old, when my whole family applauded me, I remember the song was "Jambalina Cove, Spine of Gilly Gumbo. Cause tonight I'm gonna meet my Shadow Mio. Pick a spot filled with Guy Handy Gale. Son of a gun, we're having fun on the bayou." And I think that's when I got my ho, 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 ho. And then my family just started applauding me, and I was like 3 years old. And I said, that's what I want to be the rest of my life. I want to perform.
Ronnie Spector speaking to Terry Gross in 1987. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1987 interview with Ronnie Spector, the singer who rose to fame as the lead singer of the Ronettes. She died last week at age 78.
Let's get to more of your recordings with the Ronettes. You first signed with a small label called Colpix Records.
And, that's right.
Those records never really became hits. How did you sign with Phil Spector, with whom you really recorded your best-known records?
Well, what we did, we were still with Colpix at the time when we met Phil. And he had my mother go down to Colpix Records and tell them that we didn't want any part of show business. We wanted to go back to school, and we just didn't want to sing anymore. And this was all Phil's plan, and my mother's and Phil's plan to get us on his label. So they released us, Colpix, and naturally we hadn't had any hits from them, so it wasn't like they were letting go these big stars. You know, we hadn't had any hit records, so it was perfect. And my mother went there one day, and she got them to release us because we were underage, and my mother said, they don't want to sing anymore. And about 6 months later, we had a number one record, so.
Fooled everybody.
Yeah. So that's how we got to be with Phil on Philly's Records. But that's not how we met him, you see. My sister and myself and my cousin got together one night, and we said, how are we going to meet this Phil Spector? We hear he's the best producer in the world. And my sister said, well, why don't we pretend we're dialing him. We knew the number to his office. We called his office one day, and we said, hi. We're calling for an audition. We're the Ronettes. Her name was Joni, Phil's secretary. She said, well, maybe, I don't know if Phil is auditioning, that I hold on. So we held on, and next thing we know, Phil was on the phone, and he said, I'd like to meet you girls the next night at Mirror Sound here in New York. And we couldn't believe it, and we did. And yeah, we sat down at the piano at Mirror Sound, and Phil said, sing me some songs that you guys just, you know off the radio. And of course, by my loving Frankie Lyman, I started singing Why Do Fools Fall in Love, ABCs of Love, and he immediately fell in love with my voice. And he said, that's the voice I've been looking for.
Once he started working with you, did he make suggestions to you and the Ronettes about changes he wanted to hear in either the harmonies or the lead vocals?
No, because first of all, the backgrounds weren't just my sister and my cousin. It was like we had about 10 people. There was Cher, there was Sonny, there was Darlene Love. He had like 10, 20, and he would make those, double those voices. So it was, I don't know, it was very complicated in the studio, but it was... Watching him work was a miracle to me. Watching Phil Spector work in the studio.
You both became lovers. Did that add a certain drama to your performances when you worked together?
It may have, but I guess because I was performing so much before I met him, I just had that. I love performing, and I don't think he, by falling in love with him, made me any better as far as my singing. I just think he knew what materials to pick out for us, you know, song-wise, like Be My Baby, Walking in the Rain. And he was just a great producer.
Walking in the Rain, we've heard some of Be My Baby's. Walking in the Rain, one of your favorites of the records that you recorded?
Be My Baby is my number one. I love it forever. And Walking in the Rain, I love it too. Yes, I really do.
I love that too. Why don't we hear a few seconds of it, and then we'll talk some
more.
Okay, this is the Ronettes.
I want him, and I need him, and someday, some way, I'll meet him. He'll be kind of shy and real good looking too, and I'll be certain he's my guy by the things he'll like to do, like walking in the rain and wishing on the stars up above and being so in love. Oh, oh, oh.
Oh, Ronnie, that sounds great. That's Ronnie Spector singing along with a record from the 1960s of Walking in the Rain.
I couldn't help it, Terry.
Oh, that's terrific. You gave up rock and roll for a while when you married Phil Spector.
That's not the right way to put it. I didn't give it up. As a matter of fact, I didn't know when I got married that I would never sing again. I thought, as a matter of fact, I would be recording a little bit more and maybe touring a little less. But I had no idea I would never record again or sing again or perform again. I sang again, but I didn't perform again.
So it was kind of against your will that you
started. Yeah, it was something I didn't expect.
Well, during that period, did you sing a lot in the house just to keep your voice in shape?
No, because there was no rock and roll allowed in my house then. It was only classical music played throughout the whole house. And how can I sing the classical music, you know, rock and roll? And I just didn't sing. I just, at night I would go to sleep, I remember, and just turn over and just think about being on stage and singing. Occasionally when I was in the bathroom, in the bathtub, I'd sing songs and stuff, but never too loud because he'd get angry.
Yeah, there was no rock and roll because your husband of the time, Phil Spector, didn't want it in the house. When you left that marriage and you left mm-hmm. him and you tried to re-enter the music business again, had you lost your bearings for a while? Was it hard for you to find your place? You'd been out of the scene for a while, mm-hmm. and you hadn't even been listening to the music for a while.
Right. No, but I never lost my bearing. It's like, I guess it's like riding a bicycle. Once you, you know, learn, once you fall off, you get right back on. And that's how I was with my singing. Of course, it was much tougher. I remember I came back in 74, and I went to Buddha Records, and they auditioned me. They loved me. And a few weeks later, Phil sent them a letter saying that I was still his wife, because it took me 2 years to get a divorce. And immediately they let me go, so I had a lot against me because of Phil. You know, people just said, well, we don't want to be bothered with him because he was known for suing people and, you know, making scenes and keeping people in court. And that's basically why I didn't get started as fast as I wanted to, you know, because everywhere I went, he sort of like, you know, stuck his two cents in at the time.
You recently remarried, and I believe your husband is also your manager.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you were ever afraid to get involved with a professional relationship that was also an intimate relationship because of how you had been hurt the first time by combining the two. Like
I tell you, I wouldn't have never married. First of all, I've been married 2 years, and I have two kids now, three and four. With Phil, I had kids, too. I had three kids, but they were all adopted. But with this particular marriage, I wouldn't have gotten married to this gentleman if I had known. I made sure, because of my first marriage, I made sure. Because he was managing other people in Broadway shows and stuff. So he knew that I loved it, and I knew he loved what he was doing. And I don't think I would have ever gotten married to a man that didn't like my career or didn't have anything to do with it or just didn't want me on stage. So really, I know what you're saying. I would have never married again.
Well, I'm glad you're back recording and performing again. It's a pleasure to hear your voice
again. Thank you, Terry. I'm so glad to be back.
And I thank you very much for spending some time with us on Fresh Air.
Oh, anytime.
Ronnie Spector spoke with Terry Gross in 1987. The seminal singer of the early rock era died last week. She was 78 years old. After a break, I review The Gilded Age, the new HBO costume drama series premiering Monday. It's from Julian Fellowes, the creator of the PBS series Downton Abbey. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. 92% of people who have used Teladoc have seen an improvement in their mental health. Teladoc's online therapy offers access to licensed therapists right from your phone. Get help with anxiety, stress, depression, and more. Choose the right therapist for your needs with sessions wherever you're the most comfortable. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/freshair.
This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bean Cooley. The Gilded Age, which premieres Monday on HBO, is a 10-part costume drama series co-created and co-written by Julian Fellowes and Sonia Warfield. Fellowes created and wrote Downton Abbey, and The Gilded Age is basically the American Downton Abbey. And somewhat surprisingly, it works very, very nicely. The series is set in the early 1880s in New York City. It's not the same Gilded Age story as in the book by Mark Twain, who coined the phrase that gave the era its name, the age of instant fortunes and the explosive growth of industry. But it's the same time period. And it blends its fictional characters with some historical figures, as did Ragtime and Deadwood. And when it comes to TV history, the Gilded Age recalls not only such period dramas as Downton Abbey, but a couple of period costume dramas from the 1970s, the original Upstairs Downstairs and the brief but brilliant Beacon Hill. In the Gilded Age, which begins in 1882, you get a few mentions of or appearances by some actual historical figures. Architect Stanford White, Red Cross founder Clara Barton, Lady Astor, the Rockefellers and Vanderbilts, and so on. But mostly, you get a whole host of original characters, set up naturally for contrast and conflict. Rich and poor, old money and new, power brokers and household workers. And very quickly, we get to know and care about all of them. The central character of the Gilded Age is Marion Brooke, a young woman living with her father in rural Pennsylvania. Marion is played by Louisa Jacobson, who looks and carries herself like a young Meryl Streep. I wrote that in my notes, then learned afterward that she actually is Meryl Streep's youngest daughter. We meet her as Marion just after Marion's father Henry has died. The family solicitor, played by Thomas Cockerell, calls her into his office to discuss the terms of her inheritance. The news is not good.
Miss Brooke, the plain fact is, I've looked into the estate of the late Mr. Brooke.
The late General Brooke.
The late General Brooke. And I cannot find any assets beyond the contents of his bank account.
And the house?
The house is rented, Miss Brooke.
I'm sure that's wrong.
No, I'm afraid not.
But my father always said... I see. So how much is left?
I've paid the funeral charges and other outstanding accounts, and I will waive my own fee.
There's no need.
There is every need. You will have in your possession somewhere in the region of $30.
You see, Mr. Rakes, none of this is what my father told me.
So I gathered.
With no place else to go, Marion seeks refuge by traveling to New York City, the home of her father's two sisters, Ada and Agnes. This is where the Gilded Age could have gone off the rails, because the sisters are played by big-name actresses who might have shattered the illusion. But instead, they cement it. Ada is portrayed sweetly and humorously by Cynthia Nixon, and Agnes, the society matron who despises the newly wealthy people moving into her Fifth Avenue neighborhood, is played to dry perfection by Christine Baranski.
What does she say?
She thanks you for the letter that you did not show me, and for the tickets that you purchased without my knowledge. She means to join us here just as soon as she has closed the house and sold her furniture.
What a relief.
A relief? And who is to support her? Exactly. Me. With the Van Ryn money, which was not achieved at no cost to myself. You were allowed the pure and tranquil life of a spinster. I was not.
I'm very grateful.
So you should be.
Well, I'm glad she's coming. And if my letter played a part in her decision, then I'm glad I sent it.
I doubt it was your letter. More likely, she has discovered her father left her without a penny to her name. Henry couldn't provide for a dog in a ditch. He never kept a dollar in his pocket. If there were women or drink within 500 miles.
Agnes, our brother has died.
Our brother, with whom we have had no connection these many years.
We should have gone for the funeral anyway.
Wasn't worth an uncomfortable day of travel to make sure Henry was dead.
Elsewhere in the Gilded Age, Danae Benton plays Peggy, a young black woman who wants to be a writer. She has to fight for almost everything, even within her Brooklyn family. And the prejudice she encounters is a meaty new subplot for fellows to explore. Another character, the ruthless tycoon George Russell, played by Morgan Spector, has made a fortune, a new one, by building railroads. But the old society types, including Agnes, refuse to accept him. This particularly angers his wife Bertha, who, like her husband, is used to getting her way. She's played by the superb Carrie Coons, who was so fabulous in The Leftovers and her season of TV's Fargo, and is fabulous again here. In this scene, she's overseeing the move into her opulent new mansion while welcoming her son home from college. Her son doesn't want to stay long.
But I should get going. I'm catching the 11 o'clock train to Rhode Island.
But you've only just got home.
Is that what this is?
Well, take a later train, at least. We haven't seen you all semester.
But it'll be fun. It's the one Mrs. Fish told us to catch, and most of the party are traveling on it.
Who was in the party, do you know?
The usual crowd. Ogden Golett and his wife, the Joneses, the Wilsons, Carrie Astor.
Carrie Astor?
I think so.
Do you know her? You never said.
I don't. Not really. Not much.
Then get to know her and catch that train.
Mother.
I know what I'm doing.
We finished the gilding in the ballroom, Mrs. Russell.
No, you think you have finished the gilding, Mr. Kowalski, but nothing is finished till I decide.
I'm going, Mother. Where's Gladys?
Why?
I want to say goodbye to her.
I'll say it for you. She's gone to the park with Miss Grant.
She's not a child anymore, and you shouldn't treat her as one.
She's a child until I say.
It takes most of the first episode to introduce and establish these characters. But once that's done, the drama shifts into high gear, and you completely buy into all of the players, even the most familiar stars, as their characters. And another dazzling star in the Gilded Age is the setting of New York itself, circa 1882. Indoors, we see the opulent rooms and meals that made Downton Abbey so much of a visual treat. And when the Gilded Age ventures outdoors, we see Fifth Avenue, only retrofitted with muddy streets. We see Bethesda Fountain in Central Park, only it's relatively new. And we see the arm and torch of what eventually would become the Statue of Liberty, on display as a fundraiser to gather the necessary donations to secure and transport the entire statue. It's a fascinating time in the history of the city and our country, and co-writers Fellows and Warfield have lots of fun with it. And with its characters, who, as in Downton Abbey, all establish their own personalities and desires. Give the Gilded Age a chance, and I predict you'll have fun with it, too. On Monday's show, we consider the life and work of Buster Keaton. By the age of 5, he was a star in his family's knockabout vaudeville act. He went on to direct and star in silent films, performing jaw-dropping, dangerous stunts. Many film historians regard his movies as works of genius. 7 of Keaton's silent films are on the National Film Registry. We speak with Slate film critic Dana Stevens, who's written a new book about Keaton. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shurrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support by Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hertzfeld, and Al Banks. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.